Welcome to the Enduring Curiosity Podcast. I am your host, Greg Outer. Join us as we seek solutions to the challenges facing our world today. Through curiosity, we can forge a resilient future for all life on this planet. Welcome back to the Enduring Curiosity Podcast. I am your host, Greg Outer. This week, we meet Kate Fleming and Tom Woodruff of the 50 States Project, an anthropological and artistic adventure documenting the United States through painting and photography. They recently concluded their epic journey spanning all 50 states in search of the unvarnished truth of America as told by the communities they encountered along the way. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Hello.
The 50 States Project comes from this long tradition of writers and artists who go out on the road across America seeking to figure out what is America? What is this nebulous idea that defines us? They each have their internal and external motivations for that. Some of them are actually seeking something inside of themselves in the process. What were some of the reasons why each of you went on this quest?
So this project has kind of a long history because in 2016, Tom and I spent 6 months traveling around Australia in a camper that we had bought over there. And as we were traveling around Australia, we kept meeting all of these Australians and Germans and people from all over the world that were better traveled in the US than we were. And that's kind of a disturbing thing to realize that you don't actually know your own country very well. So that kind of planted the seed of this idea of, okay, what if we did something like this trip, but did it in our own country? Then later that year, Trump was elected, and we really felt like we didn't know our own country, especially after growing up in the DC area, which is such a cultural bubble. And so that sort of seed of an idea continued to grow into this thought that, okay, we really need to get out there and get to know our country. It was always a learning exercise. I don't think at the beginning, we thought very much about sort of our own personal growth other than just like learning about the country as a whole and trying to dispel this feeling that we didn't know anything about our own home.
For me, you know, like Kate said, it started when Trump was elected in 2016, and I sort of for the first time became aware of, you know, that our democracy is, you know, delicate. And there's not this sort of assurance that it's going to last forever. And I sort of, you know, started wondering what the future of our democracy is in the country. And then, you know, getting out on the road was a way to sort of explore that question. And, you know, it was also a way to have some control. You know, I think that, you know, myself and like a lot of other people felt, you know, really out of control, you know, starting in 2016 when Trump got elected. And I think this trip was in part sort of getting back some of that control.
Yeah, I did feel like we were doing something, like we were doing something toward a goal. And I guess if there is any sort of more personal note to it, it was just this idea of adventure. And we both were sort of, Tom was in grad school and I was working, and we both were ready for an adventure. And our last big adventure had been a few years prior, and we were like, okay, we're not ready to be full grown-ups yet. Like, we need to go have some fun still before we settle into that lifestyle, if we ever do.
So what were some assumptions or preconceptions that you had about the country? Because it seems like a lot of folks, especially who work or live in the D.C. area, have these kind of going out into middle America kind of stories. A lot of them are connected to political campaigns, but yours was, I would say, more authentic and organic than that. What were some things that you believed that turned out to be, you know, completely, you know, from media or from nostalgia or for something from some place that you don't even know where it came from?
Oh, well, you're going to force us to out ourselves as being totally biased and have some terrible preconceived notions, which we have now dispelled. But yeah, we grew up in Arlington, Virginia, which is just across the river from Washington, D.C. And I think we grew up believing that this is the center of the universe, essentially.
Yeah.
And that everything in the world kind of is related to what happens here. And wow, it's amazing. That's actually not true.
Yeah. And you mentioned middle America, you know, middle America is like the middle of nowhere. It's a preconceived notion. Mm-hmm. You know, flyover country is... we've heard people refer to it many times on the trip. Yeah.
The idea that, you know, how could anyone possibly live a fulfilling life in the center of the country? That just doesn't compute, you know, all these things, which now after going to all these places, it's like deeply silly and ridiculous because there are so many incredible places to live in this country. All over it, not just on the coast, also in the middle. Also, just kind of like a more specific note, we both thought New Jersey was terrible. It's not, actually. One third of New Jersey is wilderness, which is like the largest percentage of any state on the eastern seaboard. And it has this beautiful wilderness area called the Pine Barrens, which stretches over like 20 million acres or something like that. You're going to have to fact check me because could be wrong. But that's just one little example of, you know, we all, or certainly not all of us, but many of us hold these ideas that we sort of know to be true because we saw it in a movie or whatever. And once you go there, you realize, oh, that's not real.
Yeah. I think also, you know, to make it political, there's sort of an assumption that like there's a right and a wrong side. Right being, you know, this sort of liberal elite on the East and West Coast, and wrong is everyone else, you know? And so I think, and, you know, I think we, you know, if we had those sort of feelings, but, you know, it's not like we believe that 100%.
Yeah, of course not. I mean, I think we're also exaggerating a bit these sort of ideas to sort of make the point that we all hold these sort of unflattering preconceived notions about places that we don't really know anything about. And going to those places is a really incredible way to become aware of your own biases and preconceived notions and to absolutely shatter them, which we did. So I promise we're not terrible.
Well, the reason I ask that is not to paint you guys into a wall as being bad people, but it's a key part of your method of work. It's that you are immersing yourselves into these environments, into these communities, into these surroundings, and directly responding to them to capture the moment, to capture the now, to capture the authentic reality of that place. How did using that kind of method in the field impact the type of art that you were creating and the types of experiences you had while creating that art?
We both have this working method, me as a painter and Tom as a photographer, where we are making our work right there out in the world. There's no studio. There's no closing the door and putting on headphones. It's I'm painting and I'm right here in the middle of a parking lot. Anyone can talk to me. Tom's in a city or in a town. He's 6'4". He has a large camera. He's very visible. We're right out there in the world doing what we do. And that does definitely impact the experience of making the work. And we both have very different experiences despite having similar working methods. As a painter and also a woman of small stature, people love to approach me and they really love to chat and they really love to feel entitled to my time in a certain sense and ask a lot of questions, which is great. I've met a lot of really interesting people that way, but it can also be challenging when the light's changing fast and I'm trying to capture something and I'm working and to sort of the unknown outside observer, it just looks like I'm sort of leisuring. And so that can be challenging when I'm trying to get work done and people are just want to be engaged with me and what I'm doing. Tom kind of has the opposite experience.
Yeah. People are usually either don't pay any attention to me or they're threatened by me. You know, I get yelled at a lot because a photographer walking around taking photos of random people, you know, is not seen as like a fun thing like painting is.
Well, I think people are concerned about their privacy and stuff, whereas no one's like, oh, you're going to capture such a great likeness of me that it's going to be all over the internet, you know?
Yeah, right. Which I'm, you know, I'm jealous of because Kate usually has so much more of a positive interaction in her day when she goes out making her art. You know, we'll both go out and we'll both come back and she'll be like, I talked to these many people and like everyone was so encouraging and sometimes annoying. And I'm like, I just got yelled at for like 2 hours. And
I know. I'm like, sucked. People gave me presents and bought me water and
right, yeah. all these things. Yeah.
It's definitely two different worlds of sort of a similar working method.
Yeah. But at this point I'm pretty used to it. I mean, yeah, I've been doing it for a while. So, but I do get jealous sometimes that people aren't, you know, super encouraging and whatnot.
And like I get jealous that you can make an image in a split second. So when the light's changing, that's a major challenge for me because I'm trying to capture something that's moving. Tom, you can snap a photo and it all looks like it's in the same light because it was captured in that moment of light where sometimes I start a painting. By the time I end it, things have changed dramatically. So we're both jealous of each other.
Well, part of your journey is already online on your website as a really cool multi-part gallery exhibit that people can interact with. And one of the big questions that you ask in that exhibition is, what does America really look like?
What does America really look like? That was one of the big questions I was hoping to answer with my work. I painted a lot of strip malls and gas stations and parking lots and Walmarts. I was trying to find the things that are unifying nationally. So a Home Depot in Juneau, Alaska looks exactly like a Home Depot in Arlington, Virginia. I can assure you, I've seen them both. And so that's a big part of what America looks like. On the flip side of that, the natural landscape of America is so wildly varied beyond what we could have possibly imagined. There are parts of Idaho that are all black and volcanic and look like the moon. There are parts of Michigan that look like the Caribbean. Truly, it looks like the Caribbean on those lakes. It's turquoise water. It's incredible. You know, the cornfields in Iowa in the summertime are stunning. It's so no matter how you feel about sort of monocrop agriculture, it's really impactful visually. So it's a really big country and it's really varied. It looks like a lot of different things.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is like the landscape varies, but the
like the human
infrastructure, you know, it kind of all looks the same.
It does.
No matter where you go, you know, it's pretty amazing, you know, that no matter where you are in the country, you find all the same stuff, you know, whether you're in a city or, you know, suburban or rural, you know, it's all looks very similar.
Yeah. It's kind of hilarious actually to see the exact same built structures with just absolutely no relationship to the landscape whatsoever. Just completely like plopped down there, like with like vernacular architecture, who, you know, like it's in some sense a little depressing, but if you kind of take the other side of the coin and look at it, it's, you know, I kind of see it as funny and silly, and that's just the way that the country is.
Well, that fits one of the other quotes on your website, which is asking us why profound has to be serious.
Our trials were interrupted because of the pandemic. So we spent about 5 months on the road, and then we had to stop in March of 2020 for a year before we got back on the road and did another 7 months. And we were home and sort of figuring out how to continue this work. And we were both getting really fatigued with the type of images that we were seeing in the media and on Instagram. And it was all very serious. It's kind of like those commercials that you see that different businesses did that were just overly sort of sappy, like, we're in this together and we can do it. It just is like, oh, please, like, come on. And we both were just dying for a little levity and a little bit of, okay, people are hoarding toilet paper. It's hilarious. Like, you can poke fun at things and have a good little laugh at the state of things without, while still conveying plenty of meaning through that work. So that's something we talked a lot about, that meaning is not the same as seriousness. Humor and meaning can completely coexist in the work.
Right. Yeah, you know, I have a lot of friends and know a lot of people who think that to address like important issues, you have to address them with sort of a tone of seriousness, which I disagree with. I think that, you know, in order to address issues, you need to be hitting different tones of, you know, every emotion, if that makes sense. You know, like the best TV shows, like, you know, like Breaking Bad is a really good TV show, and it's because it's got a little bit of everything. It's got drama, it's got comedy, it's got, you know,
adventure.
Did I say drama already? You know, it's got a little bit of, yeah, it's got adventure, it's got a little bit of everything. And I think, you know, it's really important to sort of be hitting all the different notes in your art when you're sort of addressing an issue, because otherwise it's going to come off as really flat. And then, you know, I believe especially in humor, because I think, you know, humor is kind of the sugar that helps the medicine go down, so to speak.
So you traveled through the country when the pandemic was happening, when the national identity crisis was happening, when we were struggling with a lot of things as a country. It was a particularly dark time. How did the events that were happening in this country, the national mood, impact the project or impact the direction that you were going with it?
It significantly impacted it. So when we first set out, as we kind of mentioned before, it was an educational documentary, I am not involved, I am an observer project. We never intended to make work about our own experiences. It was, we are the you know, observers of this world and documentarians. That all went out the window with the pandemic, because we came back home and decided that the thing to do would just be to continue the project, the spirit of the project, which was to try and document the now, which is the sort of core of the project. We thought, well, we can do that even from home, even though we're not traveling. But then it became about documenting our own personal lived experiences of this crazy, crazy time. And at that point is when the project really shifted to much more of a personal narrative, which I think you can see in the virtual exhibition also, where we suddenly realized that not only were we telling America's story to the best of our abilities, but we're also telling our own story of telling America's story, if that makes sense.
So Tom, for your part of the project, you were focusing very much on a significant aspect of America's mentality, America's psychology, and the way that we create our sense of reality. Where did that concept come from originally, and how did it evolve as the project went along?
I sort of, you know, when I had mentioned my interest in the direction of the country and where we're going and what the future of a democracy in the country is, you know, I was also thinking like, well, what is the problem? You know, there seems to be a lot of tension. Why? And I sort of came up with this theory. My theory is that, you know, fear is in part the problem. Fear explains a lot of the issues that are going on in the country. And, you know, when we were out traveling, I wasn't necessarily sort of talking to people about fear. I mean, this is a very sort of personal narrative that I've created. So I'm not necessarily getting my information from the people that I talked to on the trip. You know, it's more I've sort of done the research and I have my own opinions, and I'm, you know, creating this sort of non-literal interpretation of those opinions, you know, via the photography that I was taking during the trip.
That sort of goes back to what we were talking about with how the project has changed. I think we set out to sort of be scientists, like gathering data, and then it really shifted to this thing where, you know, we can't extract ourselves from the work. And I think that happened a lot with your work, Tom, where you come from a documentary background, but then the project that you took on evolved to be much more personal than that, a personal narrative about fear personally, fear nationally, and the relationship between those things. And I think there's sort of a shift in the documentary photography world somewhat into these more like quote unquote biased narratives, stepping away from this idea that the documentarian, the photographer, the writer, the painter is totally neutral, and that their own ideas are not inside of it. The project became much more of, this is very clearly our story and our interpretation.
And that makes a lot of sense, because as the creator, you're naturally editorializing what vision of the world we're seeing through your eyes. At what point was there a clear moment when it felt like the project had become a projection of each of you and was less this objective observer status and had become more of an active participant?
I think that happened. I think it probably happened with the start of the pandemic, but I think we realized it when we pulled together the virtual show, seeing all the work put together in that way, and with our own sort of notes and images of ourselves and images of home and all these things, pulling those all together and displaying them in that narrative really brought it home for me. I can't speak for you, Tom, but for me specifically, brought it home this idea that this project is now a narrative about us as much as it is about America.
Yeah, I don't know. I know that, you know, before we even started the trip, like Kate was saying, I was thinking about it in sort of more of a documentative, you know, I want to go and talk to people and sort of ask them about their fears or make it a little more of an objective approach. But I think I figured out before the trip that that wasn't really going to work. I think that, you know, I don't know if this makes sense, but I feel like I don't necessarily agree with, you know, going out and asking people, you know, like, what are you afraid of? Because I think the way fear operates and emotions operate are on sort of a subconscious level, you know, a lot of times when you ask people what they're afraid of, they'll give you sort of an answer, but, you know, in reality, they don't know why they're afraid, you know? And that, I mean, that's like a sort of psychological phenomena where, you know, you have your two parts of your brain, you have your sort of like your conscious brain, and your subconscious brain, and your sort of conscious thinking brain wants to explain everything and understand everything. And so people will come up with these reasons like, well, I'm afraid of this or that. And a lot of those times those reasons aren't accurate. You know, it's just sort of the thinking brain coming up with, you know, reasons to explain the subconscious emotional brain. So to go out and ask people, you know, like why you're afraid, you know, it's like, I think a lot of the journalists who go out and ask those questions aren't necessarily getting, you know, to the truth, even if, you know.
Yeah, what person is going to say, I fear that our nation is no longer going to be the most powerful one on earth, and I worry how that's going to affect my future. Like, no one's going to say that. People are going to be I'm afraid of snakes or whatever.
Well, you know, no one's going to say, me as a white person, I'm afraid that I will now be a minority to not white people. No one's going to say that. But, you know, in reality, that is a big change that is happening to the country that is fueling, in part, is fueling a lot of the fear that's going on.
But the visual images that you guys are creating, I think, is an excellent example of that, because you're seeing people's actions and you're seeing the stories of what's happening in the context around there. And that's why, Kate, I think your depictions of human landscapes without people is a really, really interesting choice, because you're capturing things and places that many people would consider to be mundane, but there's something significantly more interesting about the empty gas stations, the empty parking lots, the big box stores, the elements of this human landscape. And I'm curious why that was the choice of the vision of America that you chose, and how that fits into this broader story of capturing the now, and how that now might not necessarily be what was or what will be.
Well, thank you for your kind words about my work. I love to hear you speak about the work. You make it sound so good. But, you know, that idea of documenting those kind of mundane places came from a number of different places. It started when I got out of school and I was living back in my hometown, and I felt like there's nothing to paint here. There's nothing interesting. I wish I was in Italy. I wish I was in Greece or something. And then I just started forcing myself to paint what was around me. And suddenly you do find a lot of beauty and a lot of interesting moments of light and interesting compositions in the sort of basic American architecture that's around you. And then I also had this kind of mental shift, feeling like, okay, well, this is really boring to me. because it's what I see every single day, but it's distinctly American. It's distinctly of this place. To someone from Tunisia, maybe that landscape is foreign. And so it's sort of this idea of taking yourself out of your own place and also taking yourself out of your own time. So something Tom and I talk about a lot is this idea of nostalgia in images and how everybody loves a picture of a vintage car. We all are like, wow, look at that old car. Or even looking back at family photos, you say, oh my gosh, look at how everyone's dressed. Look at how the house used to look. Look at how the, you know, this highway used to look, whatever. And those images at the moment they were made were so boring. They were just mundane. They were just regular. But they somehow captured something essential about that time. So the idea with the images, the paintings that I've been making for the 50 States Project is to kind of have this like future nostalgia, to like place myself out of my time and say, if I were in 2050, looking back at 2020, what would I pick out from the landscape that I would say, oh my gosh, that looks so like that year that Tom and I traveled to all 50 states. And so much of the built landscape is changing all the time, whether we realize it or not. It's slowly shifting, changing to something else. And so if you can sort of document the architecture, even the corporate architecture, which is, all, you know, McDonald's is always rebranding. If you can capture what McDonald's looks like in 2022, then you're getting a glimpse of that moment in time. Hopefully we'll see in 50 years, you know, if I've successfully managed to capture the now, but that is the intent behind the work.
And Tom, I think the humor and the horror at the same time that you managed to capture in the fear and the kind of the uncertainty and the just kind of weirdness of some of the corners of the country that you encountered is summed up perfectly in John Steinbeck's, or in a quote from his Travels with Charlie, that goes something like, I suppose our capacity for self-delusion is boundless. To all these people you're encountering, this is normal for them. But as the person who's an outsider capturing that, what do these moments mean to you, and what are you trying to say with them?
You know, that's why I'm interested in fear, because, you know, that the quote, you know, when people are afraid, you know, their minds are easily manipulated by themselves or by others. And, you know, you start to think in ways where your facts are based on your feelings and not, it should be the other way around, right? You know, that creates a world in which everyone is sort of living in their own reality, right? And how are we going to come to sort of a sort of common consensus or, you know, agreement on something if no one can agree because everyone's sort of living in their separate realities? You know, for a specific example, you know, this idea of people and their vaccines, you know, anti-vaxxers, there's a whole DC anti-vaccine parade that's about to happen in DC, and they're gonna come here in March and whatever, but you know, that is such a clear example of how, you know, you're afraid. So you sort of look for facts that support the thing that you think. And so trying to make photos that get at that way of thinking, you know, and I'm not, you know, I don't know. I don't know if my photos actually say what I'm thinking, you know, and sort of, I don't know if my photos illustrate that quote, but, you know, I have quotes like that in mind when I'm making those photos.
A big quote that, like, right at the beginning of your exhibition, David Campany's Open Road, the making of art is part of the continuous remaking of the nation. In what way do you hope this project will add to the current reforging and recreating of American identity?
We pulled out that quote from David Campany's The Open Road, which is like our Bible, basically, early on in the project when we were thinking about why is it important to do this again? This has been done before. Lots of artists and writers have taken road trips. Why do we need to do it again? And the idea is this like continuous change and continuous remaking. It's like the images document the culture and they make the culture at the same time. Dorothea Lange's Migrant Mother image is like, you think of, you know, Dust Bowl, Great Depression, that image is there. It creates the culture in addition to documenting it. So this idea of, you know, the nation's constantly changing. So we need to constantly update these sort of mental images that live in the sort of cultural idea of what this time period is. So that being said, we don't have any grand illusions about what the two of us, you know, white artists can do in terms of changing or documenting the culture of now. We always went out with this as a learning exercise primarily, but if one person looks at the work and their sort of perspective on the country is shifted, success, great success.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the personal journey for both of you, because that's something you allow yourselves to be very vulnerable in this exhibition. And we've talked a little bit about you know, how it did turn inward as you were forced to return home for a time and figure out the next steps of the journey and then restart in the middle of the pandemic. Kate, there's a you write trying to remember how to paint at one point, and that I think that kind of statement, that kind of sentiment would ring true to a lot of people where everything is so upended that you're just trying to trying to remember what's natural again, what's you again. How did making things like the greetings from here cards and the field guide for plants and animals and the dozens of toilet paper studies that you did, how did that kind of help you make it through until you were back on the road again?
That's so perceptive, sort of finding the way you find that sort of vulnerability in that kind of slightly silly, humorous work. Because it was definitely a dark time. I mean, it's a dark time for everybody. It's like spring of 2020. That was a rough time. And, you know, we had come back home after being on the road. We had prepared for this trip for a year and a half. And then we were forced to stop 17 states in. It was devastating. I mean, I felt like a complete failure. I told Tom, I think every day, I feel like a failure. I have failed. That's not a good place to be. And that's around the same time as we were talking about, we were seeing all these images and just getting really fatigued with this sort of deep, sad sincerity of all the work. And so, of course, if I'm feeling a little down, my reaction is to crack some jokes about my own experience of the world. Even writing in my sketchbook, trying to remember how to paint is sort of like kind of vaguely making fun of myself, because it's like, of course I know how to paint, but in that moment I'm just like, oh, I don't even know what I'm doing anymore. And it's something I was really trying to get at with that work, is that kind of melancholy humor, this idea of like painting all these rolls of toilet paper. Those started out as like a joke to myself. I like put a roll of toilet paper on the lawn and I stood outside in the front yard and set up as a plein air painter and painted a roll of toilet paper. And it was hilarious. I mean, it's silly. Who does that? And the painting was funny. And, you know, then it sort of went from there. And the same thing with the Greetings From Here postcards. It was like on the road, of course, we were sending all these postcards home to our families and friends. Greetings from the Grand Canyon or whatever. And then it's like, greetings from the front porch where all the shoes are, or greetings from the really annoying printer that lives in the back room. You know, it's like, where can we find the humor in this mundane, which is really in the same vein as the landscape paintings that I've been making. It's just kind of this like quiet, sort of tongue-in-cheek, but a little bit melancholy kind of work. And I'm really glad that that comes through and resonates with you, Gray.
Tom, you were, things didn't really slow down for you very much when you moved back to DC, it seems. It seems like you had a lot of current events happening in DC. You had some protests to cover. You had some other major events in DC. You had the lead up to the election. What was that like being back in DC as a photographer at that time?
It was hard at first because I wasn't actually photographing because of Corona. You know, I didn't really want to be irresponsible and get my family sick. You know, we're staying with my family. Didn't want to get Kate sick.
And, thanks.
But then I kind of came around to the idea that, you know, being a witness and documenting our time was also important, you know, for mostly myself, but also, you know, I don't know. I don't want to say it was important for like the world, because that makes me seem like I'm way more important than I am. But, you know, it's important for everyone to sort of be a witness the best they can.
And also, I think we learned more about how the virus spread and stuff. We were going to be outside all the time. And
yeah, totally.
We were all like, well, you should get out there.
Yeah.
Just so you know, casually defend your honor there.
Right. Yeah, it wasn't like I was just like, F it, who cares? But... you know, then this sort of, you know, realizing like, well, you know, we're living through one of the most historically significant moments of our generation and our country in general. You know, it's an incredibly important time. And so to document that felt exciting, you know, even if the things that I was documenting were not, it wasn't like I was happy that the Capitol was being invaded January 6th. You know, I wasn't like, all right, something to photograph, you know, I just, but
yeah, I mean, that's to be there at that moment is, I mean, life changing, world shifting, perspective altering.
Yeah. Right. So, and then, you know, be able to take photos of that and record that, just seemed really special, I guess.
So, you guys have gotten to do something that most people have never gotten to do, which is to see every state in this country and see a lot of places in those states that most people will never experience a multiple of. How has that influenced your perspective on the country and your perspective on the events that are happening today?
It's an amazing country. It's incredible that it manages to function as a nation as much as it does. And I think we're all being really hard on ourselves right now. This is a really, really big, diverse, complicated, you know, troubled nation. And it faces challenges. It is facing a lot of challenges right now, and going out into the country and sort of seeing as much of it as we could and meeting as many people as we could, it does shift your perspective into this sort of like, all right, everybody's out there really trying their best. Everybody's out there doing everything that they can. We might all have slightly different objectives and those things might be at odds with one another, but nobody's out there like, okay, we didn't meet anybody anyway out there like, I can't wait to burn this sucker down. I'm going to destroy this country. Like, no, you know, it's just a really big, really, really complicated country. And maybe that's the primary insight from the trip, which isn't particularly satisfying, but I don't know. It's just very large, very, like, really big.
I think that going out and traveling made me realize that we're probably going to be fine, you know, because you go out and, like, you know, the country's not on fire like you read about every day, and everyone kind of, like what Kate is saying, you know, everyone is sort of, everyone kind of seems happy with the way they're living their lives, but unhappy about the sort of general condition of the country, which is sort of paradoxical. You know, it's like, how can the country be such crap if you seem to be living a pretty good life? And I think you can only know that by actually going out and experiencing that for yourself.
I think it was a major empathy building exercise too. And also, once you've been to a place and you have a connection to a place, you just think and feel differently about it. And I've also come to realize how, you know, as a, you know, someone who grew up in a culture of coastal elite, you realize how casually people kind of talk derisively about other parts of the country. And once you've been there, and once you have friends there, and you, you know, have your own experience there, you're kind of like, hey, don't talk about Idaho like that. I like it there.
Yeah.
Don't talk about Nebraska like that.
Yeah. They're
really nice people.
You know? Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, we traveled to a lot of places where people would be like, oh, you're going there, like flyover country, you know? And, you know, we'd mentioned briefly in the beginning of this conversation that we had those thoughts ourselves as we were traveling and sort of getting to know the country, getting to know people in those places. It became really annoying and offensive when people would, you know, imply that there are certain parts of the country you shouldn't go to.
Yeah, I got really old at the end because our last few states were Nebraska, Kansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. And I can't tell you how many people said, oh, bummer. And we were like, okay, Kansas is lovely. All right. You know, we had a really nice time in those states, and there's like a lot of valuable stuff there to see and do and experience, and cool people and cities and lots of people living their very nice lives in those places. And that's a big sort of like empathy building thing, I think, to go there and to have a connection to those places. If everyone in the US could do what we did, this nation would be a completely different nation. I am very confident of it.
So that brings up, there's a poem that is at the end of the I guess the most active or the most recent phase of the exhibition, that I think points more towards the project itself, but I feel like it's speaking to this American experiment, this American project, and goes, the work is still ongoing. The project is ongoing. The country is ongoing. What did we learn? And we're living the American experiment. And I think that's really interesting, as a way to talk about both, there at least at the end of the most recent part of this project. What's next for the 50 States Project?
So we're currently working on a physical exhibition in addition to completing the virtual exhibition. So virtual exhibition right now has three chapters. It's the first part on the road. It's our 2 weeks that we spent in sort of a voluntary quarantine before coming home. then the year that we spent at home, and then the fourth part will be the last 7 months that we've spent completing the 50 States project. So that will be an additional chapter of the virtual show, and then all of that work will go into a physical exhibition, which is still to be determined dates and venue, but it'll definitely be here in the DC area. And then we are, fingers crossed, hoping that the exhibition will be able to travel to a couple of different venues across the US. So it doesn't really feel like it's finished yet. It was funny when we first came home, we got all these congratulations and people were saying, yeah, you did it, you're done. And I'm like, we still have to frame like 200 works. It's really not over yet. And there's still a lot to process and to sort of sort through all this. I mean, the amount of kind of content that we created during the course of the last 2 years is enormous, and there's still much to do. But later this year, we plan to have that exhibition.
Well, thank you both very much. This has been fascinating to talk to you about, and I encourage everyone to go check out the exhibition. We've got that linked in the bio on the main page, so please go check that out. And what's the best way for folks to keep in touch with you or to follow the project as it progresses?
You can join our newsletter, which is, if you go to the50statesproject.com, at the bottom of the page, there's a newsletter sign up, and you can also follow us on Instagram at the50statesproject_. And we'll keep both of those channels totally updated as we move forward to our exhibition.
Well, fantastic. And closing moment of hope, moment of zen, you know, as we send people back out into the world, into across this country, what's something that makes you hopeful from this project?
We sort of touched on it earlier, but I think the thing that makes me the most hopeful is just all of the really incredible people that we met across the country. People living their lives, trying their best, working hard to make the world a better place.
And what makes me hopeful is that we've been here before with the tension, right, in the country. You know, we've had arguably worse situations during the 60s. You know, JFK was telling people to build bomb shelters in their backyards, you know, which is like arguably worse than what we're going through now. So, yeah, just knowing that, you know, we've been through rough times and we've gone through it. So what's not to say we can't get through this?
Great. Well, thank you both so much.
Thanks so much for having us, Gray. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Enduring Curiosity Podcast. If you'd like to learn more about Kate, Tom, and the 50 States Project, check out the links in our show notes. We have a lot of amazing conversations with inspirational adventurers, storytellers, and solutions creators ahead of us this year, and we'll be back in just 2 weeks. Until then, my name is Greg Outer. See you next time.